The quiz is intended for your review enjoyment, to know some special dates and happenings in the nation of Israel so that you can sort of see it as a flow of things, and to know where to find certain things in the Bible that we sometimes look for. Okay, so number one on quiz 27. In what year did the nation of Israel split into two kingdoms? That would be 931 BC. That is an important date in the history of Israel because now it was no longer one nation, but two nations, and God would be dealing with both of them individually. And the actions of which king precipitated this split? What was his name? Rehoboam, Solomon's son, raised taxes and caused Israel and Judah to split into two kingdoms, and Israel went off by themselves under Jeroboam. Number two, what was the threefold blessing God spoke to Isaac that resembled the words of the Abrahamic covenant? This is what we learned last week. What did God say to Isaac? First he said, I will multiply your descendants, so he would have a large family, many descendants. What else did he promise him? That the descendants would possess the land. And what else did he promise him? All the nations of the earth would be blessed through these descendants of Isaac. Now this is exactly what God told Abraham. And now this promise, this covenant, is being extended to his son Isaac. Now, in which two books of the Bible would you learn of the reign of King David? Second Samuel and First Chronicles. First Samuel is about Samuel and then Saul, and of course we're introduced to David in First Samuel, but not as a king. He is anointed as a king in 1 Samuel, but he does not begin his reign until Saul dies, which is at the end of 1 Samuel and the beginning of 2 Samuel. And then David rules through all of 2 Samuel. And after the 11 chapters of genealogy in 1 Chronicles, he is the ruler in 1 Chronicles. So that's where you would learn of David and his reign. And then what does the name Beersheba mean? Do you ever find that, Joe? Yes. Well of the oath. We learned that last week as Isaac was trying to dig wells and the people of the land Gerar were arguing with him. He finally found some wells of peace and they made a covenant at this well and said they would treat one another kindly and Isaac could keep this well and they wouldn't bother him. And it was known as the Well of the Oath at Beersheba. Number five, in what year was the northern kingdom of Israel taken into captivity? That happened in 722 BC. And which nation took them into captivity? That would be the Assyrians. Assyria was the largest nation at that time, and they took Israel into captivity. And then who was the king of Israel at that time? We've mentioned this a few times. This hasn't been emphasized, but the king of Israel at that time was Hoshea. So as you read through 2 Kings and see the kingdom of Israel coming to an end, when you read of King Hoshea taking his rule, that will be the last king of Israel, and Assyria will take that nation captive. The southern kingdom of Judah lasts a little bit longer, mainly because it kept saying because of God's covenant with David. This is where the Davidic rule continued. But it still went into captivity. And what year did it go into captivity? In 586 BC, what nation took them captive? Babylon. When Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon came in and took Judah captive in 586 BC, there were a couple captivities before that. And who was king of Judah at this time? Last king of Judah. Zedekiah. So when you read of Zedekiah taking his rule in Judah, it's just about over. They will have governors after that, but Zedekiah is the last king of Judah. They've never had a king since then. Number 7, in what year did Assyria attack Jerusalem? Well, it's got to be between those two dates because they defeated the northern kingdom in 722 and Babylon rises in around 600. So somewhere between there, Assyria tried to take Jerusalem captive. That year was 701 BC. And who was the king of Assyria at this time? You will read of him in the scriptures. His name was Sennacherib. And who was the king of Judah at this time who offered serious prayer to God to be delivered from the Assyrians? Hezekiah. And you can read that in the book of Kings as well as in the book of Isaiah, chapter 36, 37, 38, and 39, where we have that historical interlude of Isaiah's prophecy that speak of the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem while Hezekiah was king. So the people of Israel are taken captive, but they return. In what year did the captive Jews return to Jerusalem? Somewhere around 539 to 536 BC. So this is about 50 years after the last captivity. They return. So some of them were teenagers when they left, and now they're older individuals when they return, and they remember the temple that was built in Solomon's day, and they see the temple that's built in their day. And who was their king at this time? Who was the king over the Jews in 539 to 536? Cyrus. Cyrus was not a Jew. Cyrus was the king of what nation? Persia. And so now we have what is known in the scriptures as the time of the Gentiles, where Israel and Jerusalem will not have a king in the descendants of David, but they will have Gentiles ruling over them from other nations. But there was a leader of the Jews, and his name was Zerubbabel. So Zerubbabel comes back with the first group of Jews after the captivity and seeks to restore the temple, gets discouraged, stops, is encouraged by Haggai and Zechariah to continue building it, and finishes building the temple in about 515 BC. And then something I find to be rather interesting is that the book of Ezra is not completely about Ezra himself. It can actually be divided into two sections. The first section covers chapters 1 through 6, and it tells of the leadership of Zerubbabel, which was in 536. And then the second half, or second section, is chapters 7 through 10, which speak of the leadership of Ezra. These two men were about 80 years apart, 536 B.C. and 486 B.C. They're somewhere around 50, 80 years apart, and it's a book that's split into two leaders like that. Okay, now let's take a look at Brain Burner for Lesson 27. Let's take a look at question number one now. We'll look at question number two later after we look at chapter 28. Does anybody have any reasons why Rebecca would have her son Jacob deceive Isaac concerning the blessing that Isaac had promised Esau? You remember the story, we talked about it last time, that Isaac was going to bless Esau, and when Rebekah heard that, she quickly got Jacob covered in hairy fur and made a meal, and Jacob went in before Esau and stole Esau's blessing. Now, why would Rebekah do that? And that would be one of the negative, evil reasons, and is probably the most widely accepted idea, that because of the favoritism that was shown Esau by the dad Isaac, and the favoritism shown to Jacob by the mother Rebekah, that at this time of blessing, Rebekah tried to quickly get her boy in there before Isaac could get his boy in there. So there was this fighting, rebellion, disobedience. I'm going to one-up my husband on this one. Any other ideas as to why this might have happened? Okay, you're going to speak louder. Okay, maybe, and this is something that was brought up amongst our family, maybe Rebekah was helping out God. Because what had God told her? The older will serve the younger, right? So who was supposed to receive the blessing? Isaac, which son of Isaac was supposed to receive the blessing? Jacob. Well, was Jacob going to receive that blessing? No. So Rebekah was simply helping God fulfill his promise. That's more on a positive, nice side of Rebekah, right? Maybe. But then there was one that was brought up in our family that I thought was rather entertaining. I'd never heard this before. Anybody else have something they want to contribute?
I was wondering, didn't she have a lot to lose if he doesn't get the inheritance? I mean, there's a lot of land, there's a lot of money, and a lot of people that are status.
Right. But the reality is, God has already told her he will get it. Here's what was brought up in our family discussion. I think it was brought up by my wife, that Rebekah was actually protecting her husband from making the biggest mistake of his life. And she heard that her husband was going to bless Esau, and she said, oh no, God's already told me that's not going to happen. And Isaac is about ready to blow it. I better help him out. I don't know how much Isaac, I'm unclear as to how much Isaac understood what God told Rebekah about the older shall serve the younger. I would imagine he knew, but I don't know. Okay, what's a problem with that last guess at what might have been the reason why Rebekah did what she did? Yeah, she could have gone to him and said, hey, Isaac, no. Don't make this mistake. She didn't have to go through some deceitful means. So I still think that the popular reason that I've always heard that was brought up tonight, that there was a sibling rivalry and Rebekah was trying to one-up Isaac so that Jacob could one-up Esau, and there's this family sibling rivalry from the beginning, is probably the real cause. Because if Rebecca's doing this from a good heart, all she has to do is go tell her husband, you're making a mistake. She doesn't have to sneak around. But I thought that was interesting, the idea that she was actually protecting her husband from making the biggest mistake in his life. But just some thoughts. Okay, now let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 28. And as we read, Jacob is leaving home. It says, so Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Now, why did Isaac tell Jacob that? Why did Isaac tell Jacob what he says in 28 verse 1? Yes? Yes, it was because of the heathen practices, but there was something very specific in his own family. Yeah, look up at verse 46 of chapter 27. It said, I'm not going to be able to live if Jacob takes a wife from the Canaanites. Our other son Esau has already done it. Your boy messed up. I don't want my boy to mess up. I'm not going to be able to live if my boy messes up. Well, obviously that's not really the problem. The problem is that Esau wants to kill Jacob, so she's trying to get him out of the house. So, but there is the reality that not even Abraham wanted his son Isaac to have a wife from the Canaanites because of their influence and their evil practices. So he is supposed to go to whose family? He is supposed to go to Rebekah's family, whose members are mentioned. Who's her dad? Who's Rebekah's dad? Verse 2. Bethuel. That would make Bethuel Jacob's grandfather. And they mention Rebekah's brother, who is Laban, which would make Laban Jacob's uncle. And how many wives does Isaac tell him to get? One. He should have listened. Should have gone with just one wife. Of course, he had quite a battle with his uncle Laban there. It's never mentioned. Abraham's servant went and got Rebekah, and that was good enough for Isaac. And then So the object of the visit to his to Rebecca's family is to do what? Obtain a wife. Now Isaac pronounces a blessing on Jacob. What does he say to Jacob? What's one of the parts of the blessing? Okay, I'm not sure I heard everything. Verse 3, it says he's going to make him what? Fruitful and multiply. Sorry, my hearing's so bad, but I have a hard time sometimes. The blessing of Abraham in verse 4. And what else? He will inherit the land. Again, sounding a whole lot like the Abrahamic covenant, but this is just a blessing from Isaac. What is, this family, I mean, one husband, one wife. I mean, you can't get any more biblical than that. Two sons, small family, is about as dysfunctional as a family can be for having only four members. What's Esau's response when Jacob gets sent to Paddan Aram? Yeah, he gets married to a Ishmaelite. Why? Yeah, so he's trying to please his parents. Why couldn't they just, I don't mean to say this in a tawdry way, but why couldn't they just accept him for who he was? He thought he had to please his parents, and he goes, oh, so I messed up by marrying a couple of Hittite women. I'll go marry a wife from Ishmael. That'll make my parents pleased with me. Well, it never says that it did, but that's what he thought. So Esau's response is to try to please his parents by taking a wife from Ishmael. Now, Ishmael was a descendant of Abraham. So this would have been all in the family, which would have been fine. Not the Hittite women, though. Okay, now, Roman numeral 2, Jacob's dream. Where does this take place? Between what two locations? Between Beersheba and Haran. Now, Beersheba means what? Well of the oath. What's happening at Beersheba? That's where Isaac lives. Remember, that was the last well that he dug, and he finally found peace, and so now he's settled down in this country of Gerar at Beersheba, the well of the oath. Where is Haran? What do we know about Haran? It's where Abraham left his family. It's where Abraham left his relatives and went on to the promised land. So who's in Haran? Laban, Bethuel, the brothers, Rebekah's family is in Haran. That's where Abraham's servant went to get Isaac a wife. So Jacob is going to have to travel from where he lives, where his home is in Beersheba, and go to where his other relatives live in Haran. Very familiar places in the book of Genesis up to this time. And then we read of the dream. Read verses 11 and 12. And what is the essence of the dream? He sees angels coming up and down a ladder, going from heaven to earth and back to heaven. They're going up and down this ladder. The angels are ascending and descending on a ladder from heaven to earth. Do you know who the ladder is? Let's turn to John chapter 1. Verse 51. Jesus is the ladder. You will see the angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Okay, so what's happening here? What is being described, and where is God in this picture? It seems to indicate that the Lord stood above it. So what's happening here? Why are angels ascending and descending on a ladder? What does that mean? What is trying to be communicated to Jacob? Yes. I would have to agree with that, because immediately after that, he states the covenant. Christ is the interceder or the mediator between heaven and earth. That's how you get from one place to the other. But what are the angels doing? Anybody know what angels do? They do. And that is repeated in Hebrews chapter 1. Turn to Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. Where the writer of to the Hebrews, which I guess I'm persuaded is Paul, but isn't mentioned and isn't agreed upon, is explaining why Christ is superior to the angels, because he is the Son of God. He is the rightful ruler. His throne is established forever and ever. But what about angels? Verse 14. Verse 13, he says, "But to which of the angels did he ever say, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet'?" Which of the angels was ever created to rule? None of them. What are they? Verse 14 says they are ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who inherit salvation. They're helping the saved get saved. That's their purpose. So if Christ is the ladder, wouldn't it make sense that angels are going up and down on it? Because that's their purpose, is to be a ministering servant of God, to bring the elect to God. That's what they do. That's what is being communicated to Jacob.
Are you saying that's their created purpose, or that's the purpose they acquired?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm going to have to ask you, what would be the difference?
Well, I guess given God's sovereignty and foresight,
like none. Okay, I got you. Because they were created before the fall, so that couldn't have been their creative purpose, but it became their acquired purpose when man fell.
Well, I'm not sure that I understand that. I guess the more
answer. Yeah. Okay, you got me on that one. I don't know. It's certainly their purpose now. That is certainly the case, as we see in Isaiah chapter 6. So that is correct. All of these things are correct. But what I want us to understand from Hebrews chapter 1 and the verse that was mentioned in Psalms is that angels aren't created to rule. They're created to serve. And they go up and down the ladder because that's their... I can say their created purpose is to serve, to be servants from the very beginning. They were to serve. And now they serve in ministering to the elect, now that man has fallen. So what is God communicating to Jacob here? He's in total control. The angels are doing what they're supposed to be doing. The ladder's in place where it's supposed to be, and God is over all. Now, what has Jacob been doing his whole life? Trying to get ahead, right? Trying to use somebody to get ahead, trying to use this person to get ahead. And God is basically saying, everything is under my control. I've got it completely under control. The angels are doing what they're doing. I'm working out my will in heaven as well as upon earth. It's all going according to plan. Wouldn't that cause you to step back and maybe have a different perspective on life, that you really don't have to be so personally aggressive toward acquiring what you want, that you can rest in God, that He's doing all things well? Well, beyond that, God makes a statement to Jacob. First of all, He says who He is. Who is He? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac. A God of grace, a God of election, a God of sovereign choice. And Jacob, you're part of it. From the time you were in the womb, you were the one that I chose. I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac. And from this time onward, the Lord will be known as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And what promises did He make Jacob? Same promises He made Abraham. He made them the promise of the land on which you lie, I will give it to your descendants. Verse 14, your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, spread out, many descendants. And the end of 14, blessings to all the nations. Now, what else does He tell Jacob in verse 15? Yeah, I'm going to be with you until you come back. Now that sort of goes without saying, right? I'm your God, so wouldn't He stay with Him? Well, He's even emphasizing that. I am going to be with you, and I will bring you back. See, where is Jacob going? See, Haran was not the promised land, because that was the place God said, separate from your relatives, and I will show you the land I'm going to give to you. So Haran's not the promised land. Jacob's leaving the promised land to go to his relatives in Haran. But God is promising him to bring him back, because that's where the land will be promised. I will bring you back. And then what does He say? I will not leave you until I keep all my promises. Now, how much more sure can you be of the Lord than what the Lord has spoken to Jacob in word and in vision? That's about as sure a trust as you could ever be presented with. So what's Jacob's response? What did he do? He did what?
Is it surely the Lord is in this place?
Okay, he recognizes that the Lord is in that place. So what did he do? He made a... Yeah, he made some stones together. He made a pillar, maybe an object of worship. He knew the place was the place of the Lord, and he knew it was an awesome place, so he made a pillar. What else did he do? He gave the place a name. The name he gave it is Bethel. Beth always means house, and El means God. So Bethel obviously is house of God. Just like Bethlehem is house of bread. And then what did he do? This is amazing. This is almost beyond belief. Yes, he made, that's exactly what I put. It says a vow. I said it was a deal. He makes a deal with God. What? God has just promised you descendants, a land, and a blessing that he'll be with you, he'll bring you back, and he won't ever leave you until he's finished all these promises. Okay, let me make a deal. What kind of deal can you make with that? That's everything. God promised him the whole shooting match. Let me make a deal with you, God. And what was the deal? What did he say was God's part of the deal? And give him bread to eat and garments to wear. Hadn't God already promised this? Said, first of all, God has to take care of me. Then what would Jacob do? Louder? Yeah, he'd give God back a tenth. Jacob, you're so generous. The Lord will be my God. This pillar will be God's house, and I will give God a tenth. Who made the Lord Jacob's God? The Lord did. The Lord has already said that. What made this place God's house? His presence, not Jacob's puny little pillar. And what did Jacob owe God? Everything. I'll give him a tenth. I don't get it with this guy. Now, we talk about choices men make. And the need that men have for proof and revelation. This is the greatest demonstration of revelation and promise I know of in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament. I guess when you come to Christ, it's more evident what the promises are. But I don't know in the Old Testament of where anything is more obvious and as much is as promised here. And what is the choice? What is the response of Jacob? Maybe. No amount of vision or sound reasoning will ever get anyone to come to the Lord. It will always be an act of grace. So the teaching of this passage. I've mentioned some of the things. What other things can you say about God in Genesis chapter 28? Yes. Okay, we'll save that comment for the next one, because my next one is about man. What does this tell us about God? He's sovereign. He rules over all. What is it, else does it tell us?
He's merciful.
He is as merciful as you can ever even begin to imagine. The thoughts of man cannot even come close to the mercy that God shows. Okay, about man. What is man always trying to do? Always looking out for number one, even to the point of making deals with God. This guy has been making deals his whole life. This guy has been manipulating situations from the day he was born, grabbing hold of his brother's heel, and he thinks he can do it with God. He is so good at deceiving, manipulating, and taking what doesn't belong to him that he thinks he can make deals with God. That's the natural man, yes. I don't. Okay, I think Isaac did demonstrate faith toward God. I think Abraham obviously did. He was willing to sacrifice his son. I don't think we've seen it in Jacob yet. And the book of Hebrews says we're not going to see it until when? Let's turn to Hebrews. Sort of letting the cat out of the bag. Okay, Hebrews chapter. What chapter do we want to go to? Chapter 11. We want to see who exercised faith. Verse 20 says, "By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come." Verse 21 says, "By faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on top of his staff." We're going to see it right before he dies. There are some people who would agree with that. I'm not so sure. Particularly since he divides his company up into two companies. And he sends the company with Leah out first, just in case Esau's still angry. We're not really caring that Leah and that company get slaughtered by my brother. I'm keeping Rachel back here with me. I don't know. He's still manipulating and organizing and planning and scheming to his advantage, even at that time. Even though there is, as you say, a measure of repentance and sorrow. But that'll be an interesting study when we get to the reunion of Jacob and Esau. And why they're friendly and civil toward each other at that time. What other comments do you, what other observations do you make about God and about man?
I think it's interesting because it doesn't really say anything at the end about
more merciful to allow Jacob to think the way he thinks. And he's still going to bless Jacob, even though Jacob doesn't really fully understand what's going on, and Jacob still thinks that it's what he's doing. I'm going to give you a tenth of my possessions in return for your blessing, God. And God's like, well, I'm still going to bless you anyways. But he doesn't necessarily say,
right,
you don't have to give me a tenth of your blessings. He just kind of lets it go.
How many people have prayed to God in a desperate situation, what we call foxhole Christianity? God, if you get me out of this situation, you will be my God. And God gets them out of the situation. But God is never their God. That happens often. People making deals with God. Paul wrote in the book of Corinthians, these things happened to these people in Old Testament times as examples for us. And I think Jacob is a classic example of the mind of the natural man. Natural man who's always planning and scheming to get what he wants, even to the point to where when God has made a declaration and a vision of a blessing of infinite proportions, he still thinks he needs to make a deal with God. Any other comments? Well, I sincerely appreciate you coming out tonight. I know we're competing with the NBA playoffs tonight. And I appreciate y'all coming out. Let me close this in prayer. Father, thank you for the truth of your word, and keep us from being schemers and planners and dealers. May we be given hearts that truly trust in the greatness of your mercy and kindness and love, in your sovereignty, that you do all things well, and that you are doing all things according to your will for the good of your people. Help us to understand this, to believe it, to live by it. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.